This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
Thank you, Shannon. I recently had the pleasure of spending the better part of a day with former Spartan quarterback Kirk Cousins. He was in his hometown area of Grand Rapids visiting patients at DeVos Children's Hospital and headlining the MSU Club of West Michigan's third annual Spartan Winter Tailgate. Here's the report I filed for Mark Bayshore's WKAR Current State program, where Cousins began by telling me his time at MSU made him a man.
Well, I tell people that I came to Michigan State at 18 years old as a boy, and I left at the age of 23 as a young man. And those 5 years I had at Michigan State were as fundamental in terms of creating who I am and who I'm going to be as any five-year period in my life. I learned a lot about myself. I learned a lot about leadership. I learned a lot about what it takes to have success and to be excellent in this world at a lot of different things. And it's hard to put into words and sum it up in an answer to a question what it meant to me, but I will say it was a challenging time. It was a very fruitful time, and it was a time that will prepare me or has prepared me for what I'm going to face down the road, and not just football, but academically and spiritually, mentally, emotionally, in every area of life. I was challenged, and I grew at Michigan State.
And Cousins says he developed his character at MSU, too.
There's no doubt it was a challenge to balance athletics and academics. I feel like the greatest challenge at Michigan State wasn't to be a great football player, to be a great student. It was the character that it took to do those things, to operate with character, to conduct yourself with integrity so that you are accountable for your academics, you are accountable to your teammates. And there's no doubt it was a challenge, and Coach D'Antonio never sugarcoated it. But to the guy who's willing to take on that challenge and operate with character, you have all the resources you need to succeed. Between that academic center, the coaches, the academic departments, everyone was willing to work with you as long as you're willing to help yourself. And the person who's able to take the first step and be accountable, the job can get done.
Two tight ends, two wideouts for Kirk Cousins. Le'Veon Bell behind him. Steps back, pump fakes, looking to his right, now looks over the middle, rolls to his right, trying to direct traffic and throw, now fires. Caught inside the five by B.J. Cunningham. He's into the end zone. Touchdown, MSU! What a great ad-lib by Kirk Cousins to B.J. Cunningham for a Spartan score.
Well, I think it is important to remember where you came from, and I think the ability to look back and give back maintains a healthy perspective for looking forward. I think if you are neglecting where you've come from or you're failing to give back, whether it's your time, your talent, or your treasure, if you're neglecting to do that, I think you're setting yourself up for failure going forward because you've clearly lost perspective on what's gotten you to where you are. And to the degree that I can continue to give back, I think will continue then to help me moving forward.
Kirk Cousins under center. Starts to his left. Play fakes. Fires back in the end zone. Caught! B.J. Cunningham! Touchdown, MSU! What a play by the green and white!
For me, being a Spartan means operating with a high standard of excellence, regardless of the difficulties, the challenges that you may face, being able to answer the call, rise to the occasion, and get the job done. And that was what my 5 years at Michigan State were about. No matter how much on paper it looked like it couldn't be done or it was too difficult to do, it was a matter of beating the odds and getting it done.
All the leadership skills Cousins honed at MSU guided him in his relationship with fellow Washington Redskins rookie quarterback Robert Griffin III this season.
With Robert and all the attention he gets and where he's at first I didn't know how to take it, and it rubbed me the wrong way a little bit. And so I, at first, just kind of said, I'll let Robert be Robert, and I'll be me, and we'll just kind of do our own thing. And I learned over time, as the season was progressing, this isn't the best way to do it. The best way to do it is to compliment Robert, encourage Robert, communicate to him how I'm his biggest fan and I'm in his corner. And that's how I'm going to be able to have influence on Robert or be able to have an influence on this team. And the second half of the season, I just decided I'm going to compliment the heck out of Robert and tell him how good he's doing every single time he makes a good throw. It's not going to be false, but every time he makes a good throw, I'm going to be the first one to say, Robert, that out route you threw there in that team period was phenomenal. That's big time. That's why you were the number 2 overall pick. You keep doing that, we're going to win a lot of games. Sincere encouragement I found in our relationship took off as a result. So It was that, again, servant leadership. Take your pride down. I know, Kirk, you want to be a starter. You'd like to be Robert. You're not right now. Rather than say, I'm going to do my thing and let Robert do his and never really have any influence or any relationship, lay down your pride, go over to him and swallow your pride and communicate to him, even if he's not going to give it back to you. If he's not going to be the same way back to you, keep loving on him, keep serving on him, and watch what happens. And I was able to watch what happened over the last 6 weeks of the year, and it was a pretty neat deal to grow in a relationship with him.
Cousins was excited when he got to play against the eventual Super Bowl champion Baltimore Ravens this past season.
I always said it'd be interesting to play Ray Lewis. I said Ray Lewis was kind of the biggest name in defensive football for all my years growing up. He's on the tail end of his career. I'm just coming in, but it'd be interesting to line up against him because as a quarterback, you look directly across into the eyes of the middle linebacker on just about every play. You identify who that is. You stare him down. He stares you down. So in terms of coming eyeball to eyeball with somebody as a quarterback, that's really the guy you have, and that's what Ray plays, as middle linebacker. So Ray just won the Super Bowl the other day, so last game of his career. So we played the Ravens December 9th, and I circled the game. I thought, man, that'd be interesting to play Ray Lewis. And ended up getting into that game, but Ray had torn his tricep a few weeks earlier and was still getting back and wasn't fully healthy. So he was there in street clothes watching the game. So I didn't line up against Ray Lewis, but did play the Ravens. And so I missed him by that much. And actually on a two-point conversion at the end of the game, ran in and scored. And Ed Reed, probably the next biggest name on that defense, will be in the Hall of Fame, one of the best ever to play this position. He was the one who met me at the goal line and hit me. And I still got across the goal line, but he hit me. And I remember walking off the field, and in the middle of the game, you're walking the field and going, Ed Reed just hit me. That's pretty cool. I've come a long ways from Holland Christian. So,
thank you to the Spartan Network for the audio, and I'm Russ White for Current State on WKAR.
Touchdown, MSU!
That was a report I filed for Mark Bayshore's WKAR Current State program, which you can hear 7 days a week on both FM 90.5 and AM 870. Check WKAR.org for all the details. And you can follow Kirk Cousins on Twitter at Kirk Cousins 8, the number 8, at Kirk Cousins 8.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's more with Russ White.
Here's Michigan State University President Luanna Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis with Dan Gould, who leads MSU's Institute for the Study of Youth Sports.
One of the things that is extraordinarily important as you think about the evolution of a college of education and the work that we've done is the extraordinary science that's been a part of thinking about sport. And the college, the Department of Kinesiology, does a lot of things that is not the old PE. It's not your what you would imagine in that department. It's extraordinarily science-based. And Don Gold has been a part of that work for a very long time. And one of the emphasis we've had is worrying about youth in sport. From a physiological perspective, a psychological perspective, and also the nature and culture of sports. So it's really a pleasure for me to introduce somebody I've known for a very long time and someone who really is the head of our Institute for the Study of Youth Sports. So, Dan, thank you for being here. And tell people what occupies your time these days as you think about the issues of youth and sport.
Yeah, well, the Institute's been around for almost 30 years now, and we're started by the legislature of the state of Michigan because they had concern about children in sport. And our purpose is pretty simple, to scientifically study the benefits and detriments of sport for children and youth, and as you alluded to, physical, psychological, social, and then to partner with organizations to help enrich communities in Michigan and nationwide, to really help families do a better job so kids get benefits from sport. So some of the things that we're working on, we're doing a lot of work right now on sport parents and how to help them be optimally involved. Like Jim Pavarnik of our department studies pregnancy and exercise. And if moms are more, when they're pregnant, active, they tend to have kids that have some physical benefits. So we know we need parent involvement in physical activity at a very young age. But then the more we talk to high school coaches, you hear about the over-involved parent and, you know, kind of the crazy sport parent. And yet our research shows 7 out of 10 parents are pretty darn good. And there's, you know, one or two that get overexcited. So how do we help educate that parent and the coaches so it's better for the kids?
Well, Dan, this radio show is not going to be enough time for all the questions that I have for you. I think we need a mini series to get much of it out. But it's interesting that as you look at our media today, the attention and the focus that's being placed on a topic that you do a great amount of research in, the entitlement word that's used so much of young kids coming up, whether it be in sports or just in general. Much of the conversation's been about a child's lifestyle getting impacted early on based upon sport and evolving through college and then into the workplace. And it's the trophy for everyone mentality. It's the intensity that perhaps a college coach will deliver to a student athlete for the first time when they've always received nothing but praise and that whole process. And I don't even know how to dabble into this because it's a very broad concept, but it's something that is concerning to those of us in intercollegiate athletics, because what we're seeing from a coaching perspective, we were just talking about it earlier, is coaches have had an opportunity to evolve with changing students as they come in, and now it's changing so fast that the pace and the ability to keep up has been quite a challenge for coaches in all sports, frankly.
Yeah, that's a great point. There's a lot of challenges today. And on one hand, we know at the youngest ages, kids need very positive experiences in sport. They need to feel good about themselves, feel successful, feel competent. And at the same time, they also need to learn life lessons like responsibility
and losing
and winning. and when does that come in the formula? And there's a lot of interesting research right now on athletic talent development. And kids go through phases like fun and fundamentals.
Right.
So you don't want too early of sports specialization. You want to try multiple sports, do things like that. Then they learn how to train, and then they train to train. And then like here at Michigan State, they're training to perform and win.
Right.
And it's a developmental progress. And some of our research now looks at responsibility and how kids are, how you can, as a coach, kind of have a positive environment.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not always fun. In fact, we have a study of an intensive wrestling camp now that we're dubbing. It's just underway. Navy SEAL training meets positive youth development, because the coach is very interesting that he physically, with the kids' choice and parents, pushes kids, but then talks a lot about lessons in life, and they have reflective journals at night. So it's a real interesting combination of how you can use physical activity to learn some life values. But some of those lessons are tough, and mm-hmm. it's really important for kids to learn how to lose as well as win. And I think over the years, we've been so concerned with the self-esteem, which is important, that we forgot. It's not just about being positive. It's important to be contingent.
Yeah.
So you have to earn it.
When I grew up in Lexington, Michigan, which is up in the Thumb, and I was at Meyer Elementary School, and there was the dreaded rope.
Mm-hmm.
And as a young child, I mean, it still sits with me today. There's three categories. There's the people that didn't try, there's the people that tried and failed, and there's the people that made it to the top. And I think, you know, I was in that first category for a long time. I was scared to death to try because you'd see, and you know, I can't do that. I was probably as proud of the time I tried and didn't make it to the top as the time I made it to the top. And it's the ropes are non-existent in elementary schools today. And part of that's probably because of safety. and part of it is probably because parents have said, I don't want my child put in that condition of being bullied from being in the category of not trying. But as you go through and you watch baseball, softball, soccer, at what age Is it okay to learn how to lose? At what age is it okay to make that transition from T-ball, where everybody runs around the bases, to actually there's a winner and a loser, and it should hurt a little bit to lose, and it should feel good to win. And when you lose, there's life lessons that you're going to carry with you for the rest of your life.
Yeah, great question. I don't think we have an exact answer, but I would say there's a lot of research that shows around 11 or 12, kids developmentally and cognitively change so they can understand winning and losing more like an adult. They can differentiate between effort and ability. So to me, your entry programs, you know, below 10, 11, mm-hmm. 11 or 12, you don't throw them off the deep end into a cutthroat competitive environment, but then maybe in competition becomes more a part of it. You win sometimes, you lose sometimes. And I think a lot of it's the environment the coach creates. Because mm-hmm. we've studied coaches. We have a partner in Detroit, Think Detroit Police Athletic League, that does a great job down there. But we studied some of their coaches who are more versus less effective. And overall, they do a great job. And I applaud them because they weren't afraid to study internally. But their less effective coaches felt you had to toughen kids up in Detroit and yell at them and be on them all the time. And the youth development literature shows that isn't necessarily the best strategy. At the same time, just always being positive. And it's sort of this collaborative approach where you hold kids to standards. They know the expectations. If they fail, you might feel bad because they fail, but they have to sort of live with the consequences. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you're trying to catch them doing things right. So coaching sort of this delicate art, just like it is in business or other things. When I hear President Simon talk about support and challenge, how do I support the faculty and how do we challenge us to go places we've never been because we're in such a competitive world environment today? And it's this delicate balance that we're trying to find as coaches or leaders. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what we're doing is trying to help parents, coaches, and leaders figure that out. There's a researcher that talks a lot about, as a parent, when do you intervene to protect your child and when do you let your child fail? Mm-hmm. And the hardest thing for a lot of parents today is to let their child fail because that could be, as John Wooden would say, mistakes are the building blocks of success, and it's okay to make a mistake, even though your instinct as a parent is to jump in and protect your child. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of parents have that balance wrong today, for good intentions. Mm-hmm. But we're trying to help provide information. Some of our studies have pointed to something called optimal parent push. As a parent, you stress values, hard work, you make a commitment to the team. Yeah, you went to the sleepover Saturday night, but yeah, you still have to go to practice the next day or whatever it is. And at the same time, the parents aren't totally tied to outcome and winning. Mm-hmm. Winning's important. In fact, we've done studies of Olympic champions. They follow this pattern. The parents emphasize values. Do it, you do it right, follow through. But they don't get too hung up on if you're winning or losing. Or we see a lot of parents now crazy about getting their kid a scholarship. And I always say,
a full scholarship.
Yeah. And I say, go to the library. Yeah. Your chances are about 150. We want them in sports. Yeah. But, you know, so it's just sort of like focus on the process, teaching these life lessons, and you're going to have better results in the long run.
Well, I think that's the real value of your research, is connecting the sport to life after college. And it's that whole transition process is what's interesting. ESPN just had a fabulous series on youth sports and the evolution into college. And Bob Knight was actually part of that conversation, but it was dealing with confrontation for the first time. And it went into, you know, the term that's heavily used is the helicopter parent, and talked about the communication that takes place between today's college students and their parents is in the range of 5 to 6 times daily, where, you know, it was maybe 5 to 6 times a semester when I was going through school. And it's not only the parents, it's other individuals that are part of their lives that are feeding information, and what that information does to the psyche that concerns you, or you know, much of it is well-intended. Some of it is well-intended for the individual that's providing the feedback. But that feedback has evolved into things like Twitter and social media and blogs and newspaper articles, especially when you get into some of the more elite athletes in soccer, baseball, or football, and the like. And it creates almost a sense of greatness that supersedes the reality of their work ethic that they've put into that point. If that, I don't even know if I'm asking a question right
but
now.
But I think it's the whole entitlement. If you're talented when you're young and everybody tells you you're great, so then you do something at school that would normally mean you don't play that night, but we need to win the game, so I let you play.
Right.
And then everybody's treating you special. And now you get to Michigan State, and, you know, it's sort of like, I think I own the place, and, well, why do I need to follow through? And then you play for some of our top coaches like Coach Izzo and D'Antonio that sort of have rules. Imagine it's a rude reality waking for some young people.
Like, it also translates, I think, academically, because many students who come to Michigan State have been very actively involved in some aspect of sport prior to coming. They've soccer leagues, because soccer leagues are something that most communities do. It helps leadership, so they write down they were on the varsity team and they did all of these kinds of things. And they just, you know, expect that once they finish high school, they're not going to play at any level that is a Division I. So they're going to come to a high level D1 school to get an education, and they come with a little bit of that entitlement philosophy too, as it relates to, gee whiz, not going to the math tutoring we're offering right now in the residence halls, or gee whiz, you know, I'm really good, so somebody should be doing something for me instead of me being responsible for, you know, asking the professor a question. And there's a little bit of bleed over, as we've gotten so many, I think appropriately, so many kids in organized sport throughout their K-12 experience.
But in education, as a parent, those are things you wrestle with in the academic side.
Right.
Is when do you stop calling the teacher and push your child to say, you go ask the teacher why you got this grade, or you go ask the teacher what you're missing.
Right.
And it's coaching the child.
And so it's the same. I think some of the issues that are part of the research of youth sport also occur as I think about the way in which students engage with us, because we do have high expectations. The expectations here for performance are higher than some other places they could go. That's mm-hmm. what they're paying for. Mm-hmm. But at the same time...
These are great points. And I think sport in many ways is a microcosm of society. So 30 years ago, we didn't have parent orientation when we brought campuses. Now we have helicopter parents here that are concerned about their kids.
I was in the pit all by myself when I registered.
that dates us.
And you stayed in the pit the next year to see who the freshmen were that you might want to befriend.
But I think this whole teaching responsibility is really important. And I think a mission of Michigan State is for us to study things like social media, parenting, and then disseminate that information to the public. Because as a parent, you're scared today. It's the first generation where the Gallup polls tell us you don't expect your kids to be as successful as you are. You're worried about the competitive world, so you're really trying to protect your kid. And parents are doing the things for the right reason, but I think they make some fundamental flaws sometime without knowing it. And I haven't been a parent myself and raised kids. There's this urge to protect them, and the worst thing to do is sit at a basketball game and just keep my mouth shut and let them play. And then when do you say a couple things? And I'm trained and felt that pressure to intervene. So I think if we can make parents, we've had really good luck with parent education. We're also doing things with kids. We work with the Michigan High School Athletic Association for a number of years now, doing captains leadership training. Because there's this notion that captains learn how to lead. Most of our research shows that coaches do very little to teach captains how to lead. So Michigan is very innovative, the High School Association, and we do programs to train kids how to lead. And a really good example would be, how do you confront? How do I tell my best friend when I'm a junior in high school that she's not working hard enough? And with a peer pressure, that's hard for adults to do. So I think there's a lot of opportunity there that we can do to really help kids and parents. And I think their motives are good. It's just that we need to get good information out to them, tips for helping kids learn responsibility, for not being, you know, not developing entitlement, lack of a better word. And some of it is, I'll say, tough love, but it's hard as a parent to watch that your kid look disappointed when you're disciplining them. And I think we need to get back to some of that, find this right balance.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
And you're listening to a conversation between Michigan State University President Luana Simon, Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis, and the man who leads MSU's Institute for the Study of Youth Sports, Dan Gould.
Let me shift gears because even the President of the United States has got into the act about sports injuries, focusing on football in particular. You have at that one level, you have the high-profile NFL issues at another. So what are you seeing in terms of this issue of management of injuries? Because you've looked at this for a very long time. So what's changed? What's better today? What's worse?
It's a great question. We have a great researcher in our department, Tracy Kovasson, who studies concussions and learning a lot about concussions. And, the good news is we're finding things out. And then a lot of it, like I know Coach D'Antonio, they were working together on a proper tackling and football video. So I think we can do some things about injuries. But historically, if we look at injuries in youth sports, prior to puberty, the injury rates are fairly low. After puberty is when you get one kid at Little League World Series that has a mustache at 12 and another kid that's about 4 foot tall, and they're together, you get more injuries there. There is some inherent risk in sport, any sport. Knee injuries in girls in basketball is a higher incident than boys. There's a variety of reasons for that. Doesn't mean they shouldn't play. But it probably means we need better qualified coaches, more work on preventative medicine so we don't give girls the same weight program that we've given boys because anatomically they're different, hormones are different, et cetera. So I think a lot of it, again, is good at coach education. And in America, we don't do a very good job with that. You need a hat and whistle to coach youth sports. And the more we can inform coaches, the more we can prevent some of these injuries. But it's a fact of life. I think we're getting a lot of press on it right now. But education to me is the answer in that.
Let me sort of ask the difficult question about what I would call what if you're in the NCAA venue or the NFL, you're going to call performance-enhancing drugs that have been banned. If you're out in the world that I see at gyms and health food stores and everything that is sort of how do I make myself healthier, some of which includes substances that might be on these lists later on, but they're not necessarily illegal. They're not banned by high schools. They're not banned by midget hockey teams. They're all just okay. But they do produce effects for youth that then carry over either when they have to be continued now illegally or they put a kid at risk for having done this for a while and then stopping because now they're being monitored by some nefarious organization.
Yeah, that's a great point. First, if you look at the whole supplement industry, it's unregulated. And I know my work with the Olympic Committee over the years is you tell your top athletes you don't take anything without a person who's U.S. Anti-Doping Agency approved kind of saying it's okay to take because you buy it off the shelf at the store. You don't know what you're getting. So that's, I think, part of it. We need from just a protection to stay out of trouble as an athlete, don't put stuff in your body unless you're exactly sure what it is. Then with the internet and everything, it's a wild, wild west out there. You don't, and then like we turn on our iPads or computers and it's like magic. Like, I remember carrying boxes of cards to the computer center to get data out. Now my students laugh at me because I touch a button and the statistics pop out. I jump around like a kid on Christmas. Mm-hmm. And it's a miracle age. So I think kids grow up thinking, well, I just buy a pill, we'll fix everything. So I think as parents, we need to kind of talk about kind of responsible use. And we know Americans are over-medicated in general. And I think that's a discussion we may want to talk. And again, part of it's education. We have a grant right now with the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency to look at some national data, and with Lance Armstrong and the things now, they're very concerned. It ties into some of the other things we talked about ethics education. So why is there a culture that Lance Armstrong cheats for 10 years? Why is that acceptable? And we think a lot of it goes back to some of the things in youth sports where you do anything to win. No, you don't. You strive to win and you do anything within the rules. But how do we help kids learn what moral standards are and make good moral judgments? And, you know, if we look historically, we've always said sport builds character. And I believe that, or I wouldn't be here under the right conditions. But if that's the case, was Enron caused by Little League? You know, because about 10 years before the Enron and some of the scandal on Wall Street, we had these controversies in Little League about lying about ages. Mm-hmm. So if kids learn good values from sport, if they learn to cut corners, if they learn to cheat, if they learn it's okay to take anything to get ahead, then why wouldn't 10 years later we be dealing with that problem? So I think early intervention, education.
But most parents, I mean, I've watched my friends, I'll say, who are not very good consumers of the things that are there because they want to feel healthier. There's a sense that all these things are really good for you. And if they're being sold, they must be good for you because somebody would have stopped them from being sold. But it does develop some tendencies that become more difficult, particularly if you put, let's say, a young man, a young woman in a position where they want to play more, their parents want them to play more, the coach wants them to play more, and you don't want to be called wimpy or or anything because you're not tough enough to do that. So there is, I think, developing for lots of reasons, culturally or around sport, not a very good conversation about what this means. Now, if I'm the great swimmer, let's say, and I'm picked out at 12 to be, because right now we were picking out kids really early to be great, okay, and this elite athlete, whether you're a gymnast or you're a swimmer or you're a runner or in some cases you're a hockey player because of I get to play at the highest level in my traveling team and leave my friends behind. But those are really unregulated in terms of or don't have information that others who are part of this younger Olympic movement might have. So how do we get people to think and talk about this and understand what they're reading and getting?
Well, I think the internet is, on one hand, this great thing that educates us all. On the other hand, it's this, you know, if I'm a predator, it's the best thing ever. If I'm a dirty, rotten scoundrel. So, you know, somebody once said at the library, it might have been you actually, but at the library, we always had someone approving what books come in. Now nobody approves anything. So I say go to trusted sources.
Well, it's not approving, it's reviewing.
Yeah, reviewing. And
right,
and
so you get a peer review of it. When you publish a book, I publish a book, you publish a book, we go through a whole bunch of editors, people are doing content checks on our work in order for me to publish a book, in order for you to publish a book. It's true in referee journals, Nature, you can't get an article in without 10 other people looking at it and deciding if your facts are credible. Mm-hmm. On the internet, there's no such, it's not really controlling, there's just no such peer review process that gives a quality assurance.
But if it's in writing, it's true.
Yeah.
I read it on the internet.
But I think one thing that we're trying to get people to do, like if you go to the American College of Sports Medicine, look at their website, it's pretty solid, and you're going to get that. If you go to the U.S. Tennis Association, I do a lot of work with them. They have a superior sports science site, and there's experts on there. So I think trying to go to sites that are pretty credible, like the U.S. Tennis Association, American College of Sports Medicine. I think we need, as a university, that's a huge role for us. letting people know, like, this is a pretty good protected brand, vetted website that you could go to.
So if I wanted to know what those are as a parent, where would I find them? On your website, on our website? How could I get that information?
Probably contact us would be one, and we could get back to it.
Us meeting
the Institute for the Study of Youth Sport here at Michigan State.
Okay, so that's a resource for
people. That's a resource. I think going to the U.S. Olympic Committee website, organizations that are stable, been around a long time, any of your sport governing bodies like U.S. Tennis, USA Wrestling, will direct you to the Olympic Committee, which has a variety of resources that they usually on those sites don't put it up if they're vetted. If it's some site you're not sure about, you've never heard the name, doesn't mean it's bad, but I just would be more guarded than sort of like a Michigan State or a U.S. Olympic Committee where we think the information is more vetted.
Well, I think, as I said off the top, I'm bubbling with more questions now than when I even started, and we've talked about the youth. We talked about transition into the business world, and there's so much in the middle, both from my NCAA role as well as Michigan State, that I'd like to sit down and share with you either in front or behind a microphone. Okay. But we really enjoyed having you here today. You've already got a couple emails from me, and you're going to get a couple more soon. I'd just like to engage more because I think it's a fascinating connection and makes such a difference in our lives, and we appreciate what you do.
Well, and Dan, I want to thank you. I mean, I think it's important to note that this has been work that Michigan State has been doing for a very long time, that it's not simply because there's a hot issue now about concussions or one of these other, you know, more visible things because the President of the United States has decided to raise the issue. This work has been very persistent. It's something we're doing not only in the laboratory, but with sports groups and with people around the state. And you are your unit is a great resource. So thank you for taking on this important work on behalf of the children of not only Michigan, but the world.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dan.
That was Dan Gould from Michigan State University's Institute for the Study of Youth Sports. Dan was talking with Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis and Michigan State University President Luanna Simon. There's more about the Institute at youthsports.msu.edu. And to hear this conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. We'll have more in a moment.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. We've all heard the expression, it's all about who you know. And wherever you are on your career ladder, having a friend on the inside can make all the difference. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, you're instantly connected to 500,000 Spartans around the world, many of whom are key decision makers in just about every major enterprise. Whether you're looking for a way in or a way up, your MSU Alumni Association affiliation can help you link up with that MSU alum who'll always take your call just because you're a Spartan. Building your network right now before you need it is the best possible career insurance, and joining the MSU Alumni Association is the best possible way to get the most out of your Spartan life. Learn more online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome to the program Dr. Stephen Carpenter, who is the director of the Center of Limnology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And among many honors, he's a member of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, is also the 2011 laureate of the Stockholm Water Prize. Dr. Carpenter was recently at Michigan State University as part of the Distinguished Lecture Series on Water, where he had a good deal to say about the impact of phosphorus on our freshwater ecosystem. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
I had the pleasure of reading some of your work and hearing your recent lecture at Michigan State. Tell us a little bit about the problem we have with phosphorus in our fresh water.
Well, phosphorus is the principal driver of algae blooms, which are often toxic. So you get these green scums on lake surfaces. Many of those species produce toxins. They deplete oxygen, cause fish kills. That all traces back to phosphorus. Phosphorus in rich countries used to come mostly from sewage, from untreated sewage. We've treated our sewage now, but the phosphorus we're getting in the Great Lakes and other fresh waters of the United States comes from agriculture. It comes from excessive fertilizer use in crop production and also increasingly manure from cattle, hogs, chickens, whatnot.
And I know you're familiar with Great Lakes restoration efforts, but we've got some major phosphorus issues in Lake Erie and Lake Ontario, for example, largely a result of agricultural practices and other things as well.
Yes, that's correct. And agriculture is a big driver of degradation in not only the Great Lakes you mentioned, but coastal zones in most of the Great Lakes.
Now, you talk to agricultural groups, Stephen, and they'll say, we're definitely contributing to the problem. We're willing to do things to mitigate that, to reduce phosphorus use, et cetera. But there are also others that are responsible for this as well. People who put too much fertilizer on their lawns, for example, or golf courses. But agriculture is the main driver.
Yeah, agriculture is a big one, but it's certainly correct that there are municipal sources. Mm-hmm. And so getting lawn fertilizer under control, picking up leaves in the fall is a big one. So simply getting municipalities to pay for the street sweeping and leaf collection that keeps leaves out of gutters is very helpful as well, but in as a single percentage source, agriculture is the big one.
So, what are some things in your mind, and what has research shown that things that agricultural producers, not only in the United States but probably around the globe, need to begin thinking about in terms of the use of phosphorus?
Well, one thing we need to keep in mind is that phosphorus is now a valuable commodity, and after the price upheavals of 2008, we're seeing steady increases at a pretty fast rate in phosphate rock prices around the world. So, it's getting to be an expensive commodity, and farmers need to really think twice about the amount that they apply. And if you apply phosphorus fertilizer in excess of what the crop needs, you're really wasting it. Mm-hmm. And in fact, many soils are way over the limits for the amount of phosphorus that they need to have, and it might not even be necessary to apply phosphorus at all in some situations.
Now, when farmers, for example, do their soil testing, and they typically do, and look, is that something that would come out in an annual soil test? So that
yeah,
they
it,
would know essentially that they don't need phosphorus for a particular year.
Yes, that's right. It would. They should have data at hand that tell them that they're above the recommended limits for their soil type and so on. So they
so
should know.
On the one
about
hand,
that.
You have the data, but then you have to get out of the habit or the practice or the behavior
of applying it.
Of applying it,
yeah.
Which if it's traditional, that you always put phosphorus on your fields despite the data, then you got a problem.
Yeah, that's right. But now there's an economic incentive to think about that problem, and it saves you money if you don't apply it and you don't need it. Another aspect of farming that I think really is actually a larger factor is manure. And many cases, we're finding that individual farms produce manure in excess of their ability to dispose of it by putting it on the land. But you've got to dispose of it. If you've got a truck full of manure, you can't just leave it in the barn. You got to get rid of the stuff. So they put it somewhere. Manure running off into streams and lakes this time of year is a huge driver of water quality degradation. And particularly manure on frozen ground, for example, is a big problem.
Now, you mentioned you talked about methane digesters, and we have some of those experiments going on, and actually some dairy farms using them in Michigan. Mm-hmm. But You're doing some things around Lake Mendota right there on the campus of the University of Wisconsin with respect to recycling of manure, right?
Well, that's right. We're experimenting with the manure digesters as well in Dane County, which is the county around Madison. And they've got one that's functioning. They're building the second one now. And the plan is to eventually have a network of hundreds of them. And each one of these digesters serves around five farms. And they produce methane, which is natural gas. Right. So they're an energy producer. They actually produce enough methane to sell energy back to the grid. And so that's a profit stream for the companies that operate these things. And then they produce a dry, light cake that contains the phosphorus that was originally in the manure. And that dry, light cake is pretty cheap to transport. Manure is expensive to transport
because
it's essentially, it's like trucking water around.
Right.
But this stuff has a very high phosphorus content for the weight, so it could be moved to soils that are phosphorus deficient and added to them.
So essentially, with the phosphorus, you're almost getting a cradle-to-cradle kind of a thing. Maybe you're using it, you're recycling it, then you're reusing it. So
that's exactly right, and that's the goal of this, is to move to a cradle-to-cradle phosphorus management.
My guest is Dr. Stephen Carpenter, who's the director of the Center for Limnology at the University of Wisconsin. As you look at this phosphorus issue and beyond, let's talk about climate change here for a moment. We've got a few minutes left here. Storms, temperature rising, all the things that have been documented across the board that I certainly don't need to tell you about. But the impact of climate change, in addition to the phosphorus thing, on our fresh waters.
Well, climate change is going to cause a lot of additional stresses. Drought obviously puts fresh water in short supply, and by removing the water and leaving the pollutants behind, drought can make pollution problems much worse than they already were, and we're projected to see more prolonged droughts under climate change. Big storms have different effects, but also adverse ones, because big storms are huge scouring events, and they cause a lot of runoff. We get a lot of debris, a lot of phosphorus washed into surface waters, and that can lead to algae blooms and so on. And we're already beginning to see this in some parts of the country. The area I live in, for example, three-quarters of all of the 3-inch-plus rainstorms in history. So three-quarters of those rainstorms in history have been in the last 10 years. We've had 300-year floods in the last 10 years, so we need to recalibrate what we mean by 100-year flood.
Yeah. You know, you talked about the unpredictability of these severe weather events, and the science is still trying to sort this out. I know you mentioned that in your presentation as well, but what can policymakers and planners do, given what we do know about climate change, about phosphorus, about all of these issues moving forward, so that maybe we can mitigate some of this environmentally?
Well, things that make landscapes resilient to climate change also have benefits for fresh water. And some of these are things we're doing already to improve fresh water. So, for example, wetland restoration, maintaining existing wetlands, maintaining intact riparian vegetation. So keep the riparian forests, the gallery forests, the grasslands intact, or restore them when possible. Anything you can do to keep the lake edge and the stream edge healthy and vibrant with native vegetation is going to make it more resilient to these unexpected climate fluctuations. It makes it more resilient to drought, and it enables the vegetation to retain nutrients in flood. So that's a win-win. We can definitely do those.
Stephen, question I like to conclude a lot of interviews with, but you studied freshwater ecosystems your entire career. You're a distinguished scientist in this area. What keeps you awake at night in terms of our freshwater ecosystems, and what is the most optimistic thing you see going forward in terms of preserving those ecosystems?
The thing that keeps me up at night is the collision of rapid land use change with rapid climate change, which is putting huge stress on our fresh waters, and I worry about that almost every day. Two things make me optimistic. One is the coming generation of young people who I think are very conscious of these problems and are trying hard to think about better ways to operate. The second thing that gives me confidence is the technology that's going to be available to those young people going forward. And I think we're going to invent our way out of this problem, but it's going to be the challenge of the next few decades.
Yeah, it's amazing. Not only in research labs, but in garages and small businesses all over the United States and the globe, people are looking at ways to be more sustainable.
That's exactly right. And it's that local innovation that's going to save us. Yeah.
I've been talking with Dr. Stephen Carpenter. He's the director of the Center for Limnology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's also the 2011 laureate of the Stockholm Water Prize. He was recently at Michigan State University as part of the Distinguished Lecture Series on Water, which is brought to us in part by our good friends at MSU Ag Bio Research. Steve, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
Our mission is to be your personal network for life.
Scott Westerman leads the Michigan State University Alumni Association.
Sing our love for alma mater.
So what that means is when you graduate from college, we'll help you find your first career. When you move to any city, anywhere, we'll help you connect and settle. If you're mid-career and want to reinvent yourself, we'll help you find a new passion. And if you need advice or a friend anywhere in the world, the MSU Alumni Association will connect you with the 500,000 Spartans out there that are always ready to take your call.
Join the Michigan State University Alumni Association online at alumni.msu.edu.
And thy praises MSU.
Alumni.msu.edu.
You're listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.